thank you very much for those introductions. Since there were two of them, you probably had a chance now to read the handout, which is not that you wouldn't have been paying attention, which is the complete text of a short story by Jorge Luis Borges called Borges and I. And I'm afraid I violated the copyright by reproducing all these copies, but we'll imagine that you each went to the library and Xerox one for your own use, and maybe we'll increase the sales of his book, Labyrinths, and so the Borges estate will come after the Amherst Philosophy Department and put them all in jail. But after the lecture, please eat your copy of Borges and I. Now, in this short story, Borges manages to convey to the reader that his public persona has taken on a sort of life of its own from which he is somewhat alienated. Borges refers to this public person as Borges, and to the one whose alienation he is expressing as I. Well, I can't do that. I can't refer to Borges with the word I. So I'm going to refer to Borges, the famous writer, or Borges the writer, to mean what Borges means when he says Borges, and Borges, the author of the short story, or more often just Borges the thinker, when I mean what Borges is referring to with I. My talk will concern the philosophy of language and the philosophy of mind, or more particularly that part of the philosophy of mind we might call the philosophy of self. The questions I ask are, first, what exactly are the thoughts that Borges is sharing with us? Because whatever they are, I find them quite tantalizing and interesting, and not just what they might be if taken completely literally, namely self-contradictions, because... And the second question is, how does the language he uses get us to those thoughts? How do the meanings of the words he uses get us to these interesting thoughts that he's expressing? Now, I should first make explicit one background assumption. That is, I assume that strictly and literally there is just one person, one man, who is both our writer and our author, both the famous writer Borges and the thinker whose thoughts are being shared via this short story. There is one person, Borges, who writes the story and refers to himself in two ways, with the first person and with the name Borges. So what is insightful about Borges from a philosophical view is not that he's pointing out that there are really two people where we might have thought there was only one. That would be exciting, no doubt. But I'm assuming that strictly and literally that's not true. And therefore the excitement we feel, or maybe excitement's too too dramatic a word, the interesting thoughts that reading his essay provokes in us are not due to realizing that we're all at least two different people in some literal sense. It's rather that by pretending to do that in some sense, he conveys something about what it's like to be famous, and then more generally, something about what it's like to be a human being living in a world like ours, even for those of us that aren't famous and don't worry about the things he did. So I'm going to start by talking about the name Borges as opposed to the word I. Now, of course, he wrote in Spanish. As luck would have it, the first person doesn't work quite the same way in Spanish as it does in English, because they're kind of equivalent to I is yo, but they often just don't say that. They just rely on the inflection of the conjugation of the verb. I will ignore all those issues completely. I've asked people if in these, I think they're pro-drop languages, if that really seems to have a profound effect on things, and most linguists have said not as far as they can tell. But linguists, there are probably other linguists who would tell us something different. But I ignore that. So let's look at the two key terms, Borges and I. Or more correctly, let's look at Borges' utterance of these words as he was writing this essay. his use of these words. Or more correctly, let's think about his utterance of the corresponding Spanish words, but then, as I just said, let's not. Now, first, what do the utterances have in common? That is, his utterances of I and his utterances of Borges. So he says, like, the other one, the one called Borges, is the one things happen to. I know a Borges from the mail and see his name on a list of professors. So he's, as I say, my assumption is referring to himself in two different ways, as I and Borges. But he's saying things that ordinarily would imply, if we didn't know otherwise, that there were two different people there. Things that would be almost self-contradictory or maybe self-contradictory if there were one. Say, the other one, the one called Borges, is the one things happen to. Contrast, I walk through the streets of Buenos Aires and stop, blah, blah, blah. I know a Borges friend. It sounds like there's two different people. He's talking about himself as if one would talk about two different people. But they all refer to Borges. That's what they have in common. Now, I use refer here, the way it's used in the philosophy of language and semantics, as a relation between a word, or more particularly a use or an utterance of a word, and the thing it stands for. And we check our intuitions about what words stand for by considering our intuitions about the truth conditions of sentences in which they occur. So if we consider two sentences by Borges, that both spoken by Borges, using the word Borges, I mean, a lot of people probably named Borges, at least in Argentina, at least in his family, but proper names are typically shared by more than one person. But when a person uses a proper name, they usually have a specific use of it in mind, a specific tradition or so for example, I know three people named David Kaplan. And when I say something about David Kaplan, I intend either to refer to David Kaplan, the logician, David Kaplan, the linguist, or David Kaplan, the professor in Stanford's medical school. So I assume in this essay, he's using Borges to refer to himself. So given that, consider the two sentences or the two utterances, I am Argentine and Borges is Argentine. Now, it looks like they're both true under the same conditions, namely, if and only if that particular person, the guy who wrote this short story, the fellow who's famously called Borges, the one whose name is on the front of this book and whose estate gets the copyrights from it, is an Argentine, right? So it looks like they have the same truth conditions, and it looks like the sentences put a condition on a particular person, and that's what we think to be, I mean, belaboringly obvious, not just because that's what I do, but because we want to get started off on the right rail here, right? So there is this commonality then between I and Borges. They both refer to Borges, one and the same person. But there are clearly important differences. That's what makes the short story grab us. That's what makes it interesting and not just nonsense. That's a little bit easier to see the importance of the difference if we move to a more mundane example. So I want you to imagine now that you were at a party in honor of Borges, which means imagining yourself back in time a little bit because he's dead, I think. I'm not a scholar. but he would be awfully old if he were alive. So you're at a party for Borges, you know, maybe you're in Amherst. And you know about Borges, you've read lots of Borges, but you've never met him and never seen a picture of him, you don't recognize him. And a man walks up and puts out his hand, shakes your hand, and says, I am Borges. Now you would learn something from that. You would learn, this is Borges that I'm talking to. This person that I'm seeing, shaking the hands of, is the world famous writer Borges. Now, suppose he'd walked up and said, shook your hand and said, Borges is Borges. you would not have learned that. God knows what you would have thought. But you would have said, yes, that's a good point. Or suppose he'd walked up and shook your hand and said, I am I. That wouldn't have been helpful either. Right? So there's clearly, in spite of the fact that the I and the Borges refer to one and the same person, there is information conveyed by I am Borges that is not conveyed by I am I or Borges is Borges. All three are true, right, if there's one and the same person who's referred to both by the first word and the third word in the sentence. But nevertheless, they convey quite different information. Well, let's think about, in this mundane case, how you learned what we said you learned. How you learned that you were speaking to, shaking hands with, and looking at the famous author, Jorge Borges. Well, it seems to me it went something like this. First, you know English. He does too, apparently, since at the party he used it. And so you know how the word I works. The word I refers to the person who uses it. Because, at least in English, or according to English conventions, that's what the word I does. And you know that. Secondly, you know how names work. Now, what I said about I is relatively uncontroversial, although we could certainly find philosophers who said it's not the whole truth, it's a misleading truth, it's a shallow and West Coast interpretation of a profound phenomenon that those guys don't even... But by and large, everybody agrees that I refers to the person who utters it. Proper names were entering into what in the 20th century became a subject of philosophical emotions that you might have thought would be reserved for, say, the existence of God or life after death or whether space and time are illusory. So everything I say about proper names is with the ghosts of you know, Kripke and Kaplan and Strawson and Donilon and Russell and Frege behind me. But to hell with it. can that go out over the internet? To heck with them. I think we all understand how names work. A name refers to a person who has that name, was given that name one way or another, right? And it refers to the person given that name who the speaker intends to refer to. Now, you might say, well, I think that you can refer to a person with a name who doesn't have the name. Well, that may be right. So I don't claim that this is a necessary condition, but it's a sufficient condition. So if I say Jennifer, now there's lots of Jennifers in the world. But there's one right over there, and that's who I was intending to refer to. And I just referred to her, Jennifer Rosner, or a.k.a. May, I don't know, whatever, that one right there. So my intention is sufficient for me to refer to a given person, at least if I get the name right, maybe even if I get the name wrong. However, if I get the name wrong, it may be that I'm actually just giving them a new name. I mean, suppose you're in... class, this wouldn't happen at Amherst, but it might happen at some lesser place. You're in a class on classical philosophy, and the professor's been talking about Plato and Aristotle for quite some time, and a student who hasn't been paying much attention raises his hand and says, "Now this guy, Ari Watsis." Is he the one that wrote The Republic? Now, I think the lecturer would say, no, he didn't write The Republic. And everybody might just, from then on in that seminar or class, start referring to Aristotle as Ari Watsis. So he might have actually succeeded in establishing a new name for Aristotle. After all, the name Aristotle probably doesn't sound and certainly doesn't look much like what Aristotle's mother called Aristotle. So sufficient. You understand that, you know, when everything is going right, at least in a paradigmatic case, a name refers to the person the user intends to refer to, and that person has the name in question. Now, so those two things you know from knowing how English works. Now, by perception, you know that the person you were talking to and looking at is the person who utters I. Might not be true. Maybe it's a very foggy party. But we'll just assume it's not a foggy party. You know, assume it's before Borges died, but after smoking had been banned at Amherst. So you can act, it's not like the old parties we used to have at Cornell, where with all the cigar smoke you couldn't see anybody, but I digress. So through perception, you know that the utterer of the word I is the person you're looking at shaking hands with. So now you make an inference. Ah, the utterance is true if the person you are looking to, looking at and shaking hands with is the person whom the utterer, who is the person you're looking at and shaking hands with, is referring to with Borges. Then you do a little bit of common sense, what philosophers call Gricean reasoning. Nobody in a party given in honor of Jorge Borges would come up and say, I am Borges, if they weren't referring to the Borges the party was about, right? Or at least if they did, they would quickly say, not that Borges, right? And he doesn't say that, so you would assume this is Jorge Borges, the really famous guy this party's given about. And so that's how this language, I am Borges, manages to convey to you the information that neither Borges is Borges or I am Borges would convey to you, namely that the man I'm looking at is Jorge Borges. Even though both I and Borges referentially are equivalent. They both refer to Borges. And even though, for you philosophers of language, even though they are both devices of direct reference, or one is a device of direct reference and one a device of rigid designation, none of my account belies or gainsays that claim. If you're not a philosopher of language, just ignore that last remark. Okay, so much for the words. Now, now we know how the words manage to get somebody introduced to the party. How do they manage to provoke all these interesting thoughts that Borges conveys to us? Well, so now I want to talk about self-knowledge for a minute. Again, abstracting a little from Borges. I want to distinguish between two kinds of self-knowledge. One kind naturally goes with the third person, and one kind naturally goes with the first person. So we might call this third-person self-knowledge or first-person self-knowledge. I won't, though. I'll tend to call it knowledge of the person one happens to be and real self-knowledge. And I will illustrate this with another example, this from the great philosopher, also a native Spanish speaker, Hector Neri Castañeda. Now, Hector Neri Castañeda had a character in his lectures and some of his articles. He called the war hero. How many of you know the story of the war hero? Good. Not even you, Jennifer? Huh. Did you take my philosophy language course? Well, okay, so the war hero. The war hero is involved in a battle in World War II. it's a very bad battle. He does something extremely heroic. Lots of people see him do the heroic thing. Then he's badly injured, knocked unconscious, loses his dog tags, falls down a hill. When he wakes up, he's forgotten who he is, and he just wanders off and is eventually found by another regiment. They have no idea who he is. His dog tags are gone. They assume, however, that he's an American soldier and send him to an American hospital, and eventually he comes back and is given the GI Bill of Rights, which means he can go to Berkeley. In the meantime, the people who witnessed all his heroism have put this presumably dead, probably blown to smithereens because no one ever finds a trace of him except his dog tags, in for the Congressional Medal of Honor, which he gets posthumously, or so it's supposed. Okay. Now, the fellow goes to Berkeley, and he gets interested in history. And then he gets a PhD in history, and for his PhD thesis, he decides he will write about the battle that he knows he was involved in, because obviously he was involved in that battle. And then he decides what he'll do is write a biography of the very famous war hero that was involved in that battle. And so he does research on the war hero, and he knows everything there is to know, almost, about the war hero, at least in his life up to the battle, where he was born, what his grandmother's maiden name was. He knows more about the war hero, we might say, if being a little bit careless, than the war hero himself ever knew. but it never puts it together that he is the war hero. Now, this fellow clearly has two kinds of self-knowledge. He has the normal kind of self-knowledge that he expresses in statements like, I am a graduate student, I am from Berkeley, I've had amnesia for many years, and I can't remember anything that happened to me before the battle in which I was apparently involved, the Battle of Castaneda Ridge or whatever it was. And then he also has knowledge about a certain person that he expresses with things like, the war hero, Phileas J. McGillicuddy, was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, on a cold day in January in 1918, and he grew up resenting the fact that he was only allowed to wear short pants, no matter how cold it was. So if that's true, why is it true? It's true because a certain person was born and grew up wearing short pants in Cincinnati. And who is that person? It's him, the very person speaking. So judging by the truth conditions of the sentences, of course, we're looking on from the outside, but why not? we can see that, although he doesn't know it, he's referring to himself when he talks about the war hero, Phileas J., whatever I saw it was, and he's referring to himself when he says I. He has two different kinds of knowledge of himself, and that's what I call knowledge of the person one happens to be, and self-knowledge properly so concerned. Now, most of us have both kinds of knowledge with the difference that they go together. We have identified these two parts of ourselves. For example, when I wanted to know what time the lecture was today, I went to the bulletin board of the Amherst Philosophy Department, and I looked on a poster that said, John Perry, incredibly famous Stanford philosopher. I didn't really say. We'll give a lecture at 4:30. Any of you could have gone and found out that information about me in the same way. You could go on the internet. We have a way of finding out information about people generally. We look in card catalogs, well, or as Borges says, I know a Borges from the mail. I don't know what he means by the mail. I mean, I don't know if that's a good translation, but, you know, presumably magazines, newspapers, so forth. And so I see his name on a list of professors. Well, I could do that and say, I wonder what my office phone number is. I can never remember what my office phone number is. I might look it up in the book, just the same way you would, if you gave a diddle about what my office phone number was. But if I said, I wonder what my name is, well, or a biographical dictionary. So there is this way of getting information about people generally that's not specific to us at all, but we can use it to find information about ourselves in the same way that other people find information about us. And that's what the war hero is doing when he writes the biography. He's finding out information about himself using methods that don't depend on the fact that the person he's finding out information about is himself, but methods that anyone who is writing that PhD thesis could have used. On the other hand, let's go back to the war hero as he was in the hospital room in the American GI hospital after the injury. Now, we say he doesn't know who he is. But notice what we mean by that. Suppose the nurse brings him a nice bowl of soup, and he dips the spoon in the soup, and he holds it up, and he says, I'm very hungry. I wonder whose mouth I have to put that in to relieve that hunger. Well, people with amnesia don't do that. Now, slight footnote. I really don't know what people with amnesia, real amnesia, do at all. I'm talking about that syndrome we call amnesia that is mainly found on television and in movies and stories. If there's some medical condition called amnesia, don't. Who knows what that's like? Well, I'm talking about the kind you get, and then, you know, you have it for a long time, then you bump your head, and then you don't have it anymore. Like there was a movie fairly recently about this, wasn't there? No, it wasn't a fairly recent movie. It's an old classic movie that I saw. I saw at the Stanford Theater downtown where they show old classic movies, sorry, and I can't remember the name, so just strike that from your thoughts. Okay. We all have what I call normally self-informative ways of finding out about people. right? When I look over here and I say, oh, that's the famous Professor Nishishon. Probably slightly mispronounced. But anyway, now, I've learned not only that he is there, but I've learned that he is in front of someone. Whom have I learned that he is in front of? Me! That's the way you find out who's in front of you, by looking, right? Oh, this water is in front of someone, right? Who? Me. So that's who. How do you... Well, then there's also normally self-affecting actions. Picking up a bottle of water and doing this is normally a way of pouring water down your own throat, right? And he didn't forget that. He had all the... When you have amnesia of the type I've described, all the normally self-informative ways of finding out yourself about yourself remain, and all the normally self-informative, self-affecting ways of acting on yourself. He said, gosh, my head itches. I wonder what I do about that. No, that wasn't what he did. He remembers how... You know, there's a way of scratching your own head. You don't, in a way, you don't have to know who you are. Or in a way, you might say, there's one way of thinking of yourself that is tied to these normally self-informative ways of learning about people. Namely, the person you're learning about, or one of the people you're learning about, is normally you, the learner. And there's ways of acting on oneself so that the person acted upon is normally the agent. And in a sense, a kind of odd sense, you don't need to know who you are to find out about yourself in those ways. Right? It doesn't really matter who he is, the person with amnesia. He can find out more about himself in those ways. So that's knowledge that I call proper self-knowledge. Now, proper self-knowledge, though, is any knowledge that is tied into one's concept of oneself, that is tied into those normally self-informative ways of finding out about people and those normally self-affecting ways of action. So, in other words, you have in your panoply of ideas, you have an idea that is about yourself, that I call your self-notion. And what makes your self-notion is it's the concept, the file folder, the idea of a person that is added to when you find out things in the normally self-informative way, and it is the one that motivates action that is normally self-affected. Right? So, I look, you know, I have a standing desire to be punctual. Right? I look on the bulletin board and it says, Perry talks at 4:30. Right? I look at my watch and it's 4:25, right? Then I start walking, right? So if I'd known that, you know, Saul Kripke was going to give a talk at 4:30, and I desire for Saul Kripke to be punctual, and I see it's 4:25, that doesn't make me start walking, right? It should make Saul Kripke start walking. Because he should be thinking of Saul Kripke. But when I think, in other words, the person I take myself to be is the person information about which motivates me. Suppose I was wrong, and I'm not John Perry. Suppose that I'm really John Searle. And that ever since I've known John Perry, I've just admired him so much. And admired how he takes the same problems that I do and treats him, this is quite fictional. Treats him in a more subtle and profound way. And as I get older and drink more wine from my family vineyard, I just kind of completely succumb to the fantasy that I am John Perry. Right? So now he would have this misinformation in his self-notion that he was named John Perry, and he would take the information he got in these third-person ways and add it to his self-notion incorrectly. And then he would be, once they did that, he would be motivated to start to the lecture. And he would show up here and say, what are you doing here? And I would probably, since he's, never mind. So, now why do I say normally? Well, some of the ways we have of finding out about ourselves seem to me not just normally, but we might say metaphysically guaranteed to give us knowledge about ourselves. For example, I can tell you whether I'm in pain right now or not. whether my lower back hurts or not. It doesn't. Right? I can tell you whether my head itches or not. It doesn't. I have kinds of knowledge about myself that depend on what's going on in my own mind and consciousness, things we call introspection or reflection. And although those things are rather mysterious to think about philosophically, it seems like I'm the only person I can know the thoughts of in that way. That may not be quite right. Certain kinds of schizophrenics think that other people kind of inhabit their consciousness and that the thoughts they're having and knowing about in that way aren't really their own. So, some more thought. But it's pretty metaphysical. On the other hand, take the fact that I know through my own feelings when my stomach is getting empty or when I need to go to the bathroom. Now, those are things that could, by a very clever neurosurgeon, be made, I mean, it could be my feelings in those respects could convey information about someone else. Suppose you have a very pranksterish neurosurgeon who sits behind people's at theaters, very quick-acting and painless neurosurgeon, and he likes to take the little spines and brainstems and cross them. Right, and then watch how this person just eats popcorn and eats popcorn and eats popcorn and just never seems to be bothered. And this person doesn't eat any popcorn. It's going, ooh, blah, blah. So it's only a normally self-informative way of knowing. That's why I say normally, because the philosophers are very cautious. Or normally self-affecting ways of action. You all know, well, maybe you don't all know. How many of you know the movie Spellbound, the Hitchcock movie Spellbound? Yes, well, at the end of the movie, J. Carol Nash is pointing a gun at Ingrid Bergman as she walks out of his office, having just disclosed that she knows that he framed Gregory Peck. And it looks like he's going to shoot her, because that's the way of shooting the person in front of you. But then he turns the gun, and it goes off, and you know who he killed. He killed himself, because that's a normally self-effective way of killing someone, namely yourself. But suppose he had a donut-shaped head. That's why I say normally and not metaphysically. Pays to be careful. Okay. Now let's pay a little attention to the text now that we've got that picture in front of us. The other one, the one called Borges, is the one things happen to. So the one called Borges. So you've got the name there. So this one character is identifying by the name. Is the one things happen to, passive, things happen to him. I walk, active. I, the one I'm referring to, I walk through the streets of Buenos Aires and stop for a moment, perhaps mechanically now, to look at the arch of an entrance hall and grillwork on the gate. I know of Borges from the mail and see his name on a list of professors or in a biographical dictionary. I like, how do you find out what you like? Well, usually in normally self-informative ways. You just kind of do a little mental experiment in your mind and say, do I like chocolate better than vanilla? Would I rather have an hourglass or an autographed picture of Bill O'Reilly? I like hourglasses, maps, 18th century typography, the taste of coffee, and the prose of Stevenson. Then he shares these preferences, but in a vain way that turns them into attributes of an actor. We have to come back to that passage. It doesn't quite fit anything I've said so far. I won't read the whole thing. But the basic, there is a correspondence here between these, even though he is not like Castaneda's war hero, he is still able to kind of divide in two concepts of himself. The one that is more or less based on things that he knows about himself in normally self-informative ways. You just go through life, you find out what you like. And the one that is tied also to certain kinds of actions, walking, appreciating, liking. And the one that, although in his pretense, he knows of only in the ways that other people know of him, reading about him in magazines, so forth and so on. Now, catch up with where I am here. So I think that's part of what's going on there. That he's sharing thoughts about himself that he has that are thoughts like anyone might have about Borges based on things anyone might know about Borges. And cross-contrasting that with things he knows about himself in these self-informative ways, that other people wouldn't know about Borges, except insofar as they're shared through his writing and thus available in the third-person ways. But that's not all that's going on, because it's not just that there's this one guy with these two ways of knowing about him. There's also a tension between these two. They don't get along perfectly. He says, it would be an exaggeration to say that ours is a hostile relationship. Well, that suggests that it's not a totally non-hostile relationship. He resents Borges, who's getting credit for everything he does. And yet he lives so Borges can live and write and be immortal, or at least last longer than he will, because he is fleeting. So there's these contrasts between them, and it's not just different ways of referring to the same thing conceived of in the same way ultimately. Now, I think this pertains to another aspect of the philosophy of mind, the whole concept of agency. Now, normally we think of, everything I knew about agency I learned from Michael Bratman and Jennifer Rosner, but nevertheless, what I say will be very thin and gruel-like compared to the concepts and insights they would bring to the table, because a simple picture is sufficient for my purposes. But we think of agency, that is, we think of a person doing something intentionally, on purpose, not just accidentally, like stumbling or falling. Well, what goes into agency? Well, usually there's a set of what Davidson calls pro-attitudes, and what we might think in the most general terms is desires, really desires, wants, urges, intentions, all sorts of things that Davidson calls pro-attitudes, because they're things that kind of push you to doing something. And then there's beliefs about what the world is like. And most things you don't just do, you do them by doing something else. And what you do by doing what you do in the most simple way depends on the circumstances of the world. Right? So I can move my arm in almost any circumstances at will, and I can lift this kind of thing in any circumstance in which it's the sort of bottle it looks like, and can drink from it. However, if that were gin or gasoline, I wouldn't have the effect on myself that I intend to have. I tend to quench my thirst while remaining healthy and focused on the lecture. And I wouldn't do that. So you act in circumstances, and by acting in circumstances, you do further things, which in further circumstances mean you do further things. That's the structure of action. Doing this is a way of doing that, is a way of doing that, is a way of doing that, in each case in certain circumstances. The job of your belief is to fix the circumstances so that you have a plan. By doing this in these circumstances and this, I'll do this, and in these circumstances, this will be the result. Right? That's what action is all about. Doing something such that if your beliefs are true, what you do will promote your desires. If I desire to take a drink, and if my belief that what is in this thing is water is true, then by doing this, I'll promote that desire. That's what action should be all about. So we can think of action then as something that has a twofold side to it, what we might call the causation side and the content side. When I act, I have a complex of cognitions, desires, and beliefs that cause me to act in a certain way, but also rationalize my acting in that way. They're the cause of my action. So these are all little brain states, and they, you know, go back and forth and send out little signals, and my muscles contract and relax, and I end up doing this. But they also rationalize that in the sense that one of the cognitions was a desire for water. One of them was a belief that there's water in there. One of them was kind of know-how, knowing how to get something there to your lips. And I put those together, and I get the result that, the action that's caused will promote my desires if my beliefs are true. So that's my picture of action. Now, I want to note something about that. There's no guarantee in that picture that at any given time, much less over time, a single person will exemplify only one motivating complex of cognitions. And it seems to me, and it may be because I'm a particularly irrational, procrastinating type of guy, but it seems to me I often experience just the opposite happening. Two complexes of cognitions, in which different beliefs and different desires, maybe not conflicting beliefs, but maybe conflicting desires, are vying for control of certain of my bodily parts. For example, department meeting. Someone in the department meeting says something, you know, I make a really clever, rational, reasonable proposal with no hidden agenda. And the reaction of someone in the department is, well, you know, you're just saying that because you want another metaphysician or something like that. And I become angry, right? And at that point, something odd happens. You know, part of me seems to be governed by the desire to not let anyone get away with saying something like that to my face without telling them that they're wrong and letting everyone know that I'm really irritated with it, and that maybe that'll teach them a lesson and they won't do it again. And that set of desires and beliefs seems to have grabbed control of my mouth. Because I'm saying those things. But another set of desires seems also to be quite present, and in fact more conscious, right? And that's a set of desires that says, be cool, be calm, always be known as a cool, I want always to be known as a cool and calm, unflappable, indefatigable servant of the department who always puts the department's interests first and is willing to efface his own. And I also desire not to make a fool of myself. I also desire not to alienate my colleagues. I also desire not to have to come back and apologize later. And that little part of me has not seized control of my mouth, but it seized control of my conscious thought. Right? And for a moment, I'm saying one thing and shouting at myself something else. Now, maybe I'm the only one that happens to. But I don't think so. I don't think so. I think at various times, now, sometimes you write something, not only say something, but you write something, and then later you come back and say, how could I have said that? And you just mean you've changed. You don't, how can I believe and desire what motivated me to say those things? But sometimes that's not it. Sometimes you come back in a different mood, and you could say, oh, ooh, I know I have those desires and beliefs, but how could I have let them control my pen or my typing fingers, right? Extreme cases, split brains. You probably all read about split brain cases. They have little monkeys. They split the brain, cut the corpus callosum, and so all the information from this side, the sense organs on this side go to this side of the brain, all the information sense organs on this side go to this side of the brain, and the monkey ends up having a fight with itself over a hot dog, right? Because the right brain wants it and the left brain wants it. Well, that's extreme. Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson drinks a lot, even though he's not a congressman, and says a bunch of stuff that he later says he wouldn't have said if his cognitive structure hadn't been kind of skewed by the drink. Now, a lot of people are skeptical about this, but and a lot of people say, well, you really get to know a person when they're drunk. I must admit, I'm a little on Mel Gibson's side on that particular issue. I mean, when you're drunk, presumably all kinds of structures that you may have painfully built up in your mind to overcome all kinds of strange beliefs and desires that you inherited from your parents or ministers or your genetics, and to stifle them if you can't just get rid of them from coming out and grabbing control of any of your affecting organs based on your knowledge of the world and what you want to be, and then you get yourself in a situation where you drink and that's stripped away and these things come out. What does that show? It shows they're in there. All right. But that's a side issue, the ethics of being Mel Gibson. That's another, you know, if you invite me back, I'll be glad to talk about Mel. So there's these various things in which we have cognitive complexes that at different times seize control of our agency or part of our agency. Maybe one controls one, and sometimes at the same time. Now, I suggest that another aspect of Borges and I is that he has another example, just to make sure, this is not a strange thing. A lot of you are students. I see the bright, alert, thirsting for knowledge faces of students amidst the world-weary, worn, tired faces of professors. You get to Amherst or whatever one of these colleges you're at, and then you go home for Thanksgiving, and don't you find yourself being different, right? I mean, just the context. You've got students. Maybe the students call you, Joe. And, they have certain expectations of you based on what you've told them in the little bit of time you've been at Amherst, all during which you've been over 17. Then you go home and people call you Joey. and parents tend to treat their children as if they were the average age during which the parents have known the children, which means if they've known you for 28 years, they'll treat you like a 14-year-old. You change, right? Different of your desires, beliefs, attitudes are triggered. So we all have this to a certain extent. We're not just these rational computing machines. So my hypothesis is that I better hurry up and finish. That Borges the writer and Borges the thinker are one person who, like all persons, has an enormous number of desires, beliefs, etc., that more or less don't ever all cohere together, but combine in different groups to motivate him at different times, giving a different flavor to his action, his thought, and his words at those different times. Now, in this complex is one central set of desires, urges, self-conceptions, and beliefs that is tied to writing things that get published and make him famous. And not oddly, the things that have succeeded in making him famous and the points of view that people have about him that are responsible for that fame feed into them. Slight digression. And it is amazing how... it's not amazing. It's the most normal thing in the world. But, what is it for someone else to have a thought about you? Right? So here I am in Amherst, Massachusetts. My sister is in Claremont, California. My sister has a normal-sized head, a normal-sized brain. And I suppose that within that brain, possibly a cubic centimeter at most, is responsible for every thought she has about me. That's just a guess based on my vast knowledge of brains. But I worry about what my sister thinks about me. What am I really worrying about? A little perturbation in a brain 1,000 miles away. That's not the most mysterious thing. George Bush, Bill Clinton, all these guys are so worried about what history will think of them. Now, of course, George Bush has the great good fortune of finding out right away with this glut of books coming out. But I digress. But what does that mean, what history is going to think of me? That means, I'm dead, I'm dust, I'm ashes, the worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, or I'm in an urn on somebody's, mantelpiece. Or whatever, and there's these people at Harvard and Amherst and Stanford who are studying when I was president, and little perturbations go up in their brain, and I care a lot now in 2006 about what these guys in 2043 are going to be. It's as my old teacher O.K. Bowsma used to say, you have to quicken your sense of the queer to do philosophy. He said this in like 1968, so it's fairly unambiguous. It is very clear. So here's Borges, and he's aware that all these things that he knows about himself in the first person way, the things that never make it into the public knowledge of Borges the writer, that he likes hourglasses, that he, you know, scratches his head or picks his nose with his left hand instead of his right hand. All these things, they're not going to be in anybody's brain in the future. They're not going to be any little perturbation that kind of reflects that fact about him. All the perturbations are going to be facts that involved in this public persona, Borges, the one that everyone can know about in roughly the same way he can. Little by little, I am giving over everything to him, although I am quite aware of his perverse custom of falsifying and magnifying things. Well, what does that mean? And what does it mean that that he shares these preferences, but in a vain way that turns them into the attributes of an actor? Well, I think Borges, when he's in the mood not to work, just to walk around and enjoy an hourglass or two, whatever exactly that involves, and then he reads the stuff he's written, he feels this guy is coming off as showy and pumpsy. But when he's in the mood to write things, that's how it comes out. He ends by saying, "Who wrote this?" Well, that's a good question, because we've got the thinker and the writer. And the thoughts we're looking at are thoughts the thinker has about the writer and how when he writes, right, he writes in the way everyone would expect him to write and to be who knows him only in the third person ways of knowing him. And he really lives up to that image, and he writes in these ways that I, the thinker, don't like. And somewhat alienated from, although I realize that's my only chance of ever being remembered, and also that's what pays the bills. So it looks like, well, it's the thinker that's writing this, because it's the thinker whose thoughts were being given. But wait a minute, the thinker doesn't write, the thinker thinks. The only way this got into the book is because the writer somehow took the thinker's thoughts, even the thoughts that were angry at him, and converted them into prose. So that's as far as I've gotten with trying to understand this very short story and how language and thought make it possible for Borges to have written. Thank you.